I don't know about you, but my wife and I, we're fans of The Bear, the TV show on FX, which is about sort of a chef and making a restaurant in Chicago. And if you've ever watched the show, and I'll give you some context, the show is less about cooking and more about chaos. So much of the show is just loud and messy and full of just clashing personalities. It is fully chaotic. And there's even episodes that like, there's an episode called Fishes where it's like, the whole episode is just anxiety for about 50 minutes, just watching chaos unfold. And then there's an episode called Forks that's like peaceful and ordered and everything is as it should be and everything has a purpose and there's somebody in charge. And you see these contrasts as the story sort of unfolds. And even as the seasons go, you start watching it change. You start to get glimpses. Roles start being defined and rhythms start developing. And you learn, they learn sort of how the kitchen needs to work and who has to be in charge and how communication works. And it's still intense because The Bear is just intense to begin with. But when it starts working, you almost feel it. You almost feel it watching the episodes. You sort of feel a peace versus the chaos in other episodes. And it's being shaped into something beautiful. It's as if sort of function and order bring peace and possibility, while the episodes with disorder and confusion are just stressful and they break down. And when we read Genesis, I think we have to think through those lenses too, because for ancient people, they have no control over just about anything, certainly not the weather, but even their livestock, all this sort of stuff, diseases. They live in a chaotic world, and they're wondering, how ordered is it? Who's really in charge? How predictable is it? And we talked about some of this last week, but this chapter really continues with a few of those themes. And I would say, I'm not a three-point sermon person most of the time, but we really see three big things, I think, out of this chapter at least, or these verses. The first, we will continue to see order. I'll unpack that in a second. We'll see what God talks about when he talks about his presence. And then the refrain that we see often is goodness. So a God who brings order to the chaos, a God whose presence fills his creation, and a God whose goodness will shape everything he creates. So first is the order question, which for an ancient person, once again, you're asking the question, all right, where, what is this place? What is this world? Is it random? Is there order to it? What am I a part of? And we start with the formless and void last week. Any of our high schoolers, formless and void? Any of our high school workers, formless and void? Yeah. Tohu vavohu. Good. It's a great phrase. It's fun to say. Not tofu vavohu, but tohu vavohu. And it means this formless and void. And so we're going to walk through this graph. We'll do it very quickly. So if things are formless, that's the problem. What is the solution to formlessness? Form, right? To bring form to things. Pretty straightforward. All right, day one, what do we have the creation of in those that part of the story? Or what gets formed? Light and darkness, yeah. We get some of that start happening in day one, right? And we get day and night. Day two. Anybody remember? Yeah, sky and water. And just to imagine how probably ancient people imagined the creation story, you've got the watery chaos that everything is in, and there's almost like a dome that's produced that comes up and pushes the water out. And now there's water above and water below, and their dome that sort of sits above where everything's going to take place, right? That's how we have to imagine it. So there's language in scripture throughout that the windows of heaven get open. It's almost like there's a bunch of water up there above the dome, kind of like Truman Show, if you've ever seen Truman Show. And there's windows that open whenever it rains. So that's the picture. That's how they would imagine it. And then day three. What gets created day three? Land, yeah, and some plants. We get plant life. That they wouldn't have thought of as life the same way we would. And so plant life. Great. So form. We get all the sort of form of things that is part of the creation. All right, so now it's empty. What do we need to do? Fill it all, right? So day four, what happens? What gets formed or what gets filled? Yeah, we get all the things. We get sun, we get moon, we get stars. They govern all the patterns of life, and it's very religious even. So if you're an Israelite or any ancient person, your religious patterns are all determined by what? Your seasons, your sun, your moon, your stars. And so all those things are going to dictate even your religious life. Day five. What do we fill? Yeah, what do we fill the sky and water with? Fish and birds, right? And dinosaurs maybe in there somewhere. Joking about last week. I don't know where dinosaurs fit. Day six. What goes on land? All the land animals, including us as humans, but we didn't read that section yet. So, we get the filling. So the problem, formless and void, we get form, we get filling. And they're very symmetrical in their storytelling. And in the middle there, we actually get something about seasons, but that's a sermon about rest and Sabbath, but we'll get there. And so we get both of those things, and it's very structured. And to keep driving home the structural point, I hope we notice we're not numbers people for the most part, but ancient Israelites are, especially when you memorize things. And there's a lot of things happening that are patterns in numbers. And so we already just saw that there's patterns of three. There's 3 days of filling or forming, 3 days of filling, right? So threes, and three's a big number throughout the rest of the Old Testament and into New Testament, sort of this communal kind of whole number. And so we get the threes. We get that. Barah, the actual word about creating here, is used three times as well in the story. We get three blessings in the story, three different times that the people are blessed, or the things are blessed in Genesis 1 to go do things. We get three realms of creation. So we get the heavenlies, we get the sky and sea, and we get the land. We get multiple patterns of three and a few more that happen throughout. What's another big biblical number? Seven, right? Seven's a good one. So if we kept reading, we know that the creation week is 7 days. The first sentence really in Hebrew is seven words. The second one is 14 words. So we get seven times two. Earth appears 21 times in the text. God appears 35 times in the text. It was so appears seven times. And God saw it happened seven times. And so you get this rhythm of certain words, particularly key phrases or words that are very rhythmic, very patterned in this. And if you guys don't want to, like, I know every now and then I see people writing or take a picture, just Slack me and I'll send some of this stuff. If you have the number sevens and threes, what do those add up to? 10. Good. Simple math. Obviously, we're not to the Ten Commandments yet, though the original audience might be around that same time. But we see patterns of 10 throughout it as well. To make is 10 times, according to his kind, 10 times. We get things like, and God said, but that happens 10 times, 3 times with humans and 7 times with other creatures. Let there be light. That happens 10 times, 3 times with the heavens, 7 times with things on earth. And so we get this very rhythmic use of language that if you were to open a scientific textbook and read through, you don't find. This is meant to be poetic. It's meant to have this rhythm. It's almost a musical text, not a scientific text. Less about a diary entry and almost more about a worship song, as if God's saying, God almost teaching us how he created in sense of ordered and purpose and good. And repetition even invites meditation. It's not just information. It's designed to be memorized, read out loud, to be repeated, to have that sort of rhythm. As if to essentially say, God doesn't just make stuff. God makes sense. There's purpose and order to this. So God is ordering things. That God shows us his presence is the next key thing here. Which once again, if you're an ancient person, it's like, where is Yahweh? Does Yahweh have a temple somewhere we don't know about? Does he dwell on a certain mountain we don't know about? Where is Yahweh himself? Helpful background, once again, ancient people traveling with Moses. You've heard other origin stories. You've heard about the Egyptian gods. You've probably heard about the Canaanite gods. You've maybe heard about the Babylonian gods. We have these origin stories, and they would have had them too. It's important when we talk about sort of these temples, because all the gods had their various temples all around these ancient lands. We have stories like we found an ancient cylinder that talks about gods that would be a 7-day dedication period to the temple, marked by celebrations, offerings. And at the end of the 7 days, the god would take up residence in that temple. The Enuma Elish, it's Babylonian inscriptions. They were tied to temple dedications, and they would be 7-day ceremonial patterns. And then the gods would take up their residence in the temple, the Mari ritual text. All of these predate any dating we put on the oldest of the Old Testament writings. They have rituals for sacred spaces, 7 days, including processions, bringing the offerings into the temple, and then the enthronement of the deities in it. Canaanites had the same thing. Baal's house is a multi-day ceremonial sequence tied to festivals that ran for 7 days. And at the end of all of them, they would bring in whatever the statue is that's going to sit in the middle of the temple, and it would be dedicated, and they would insist that now the deity dwells in this house. So, as we ask the questions that I know we've all asked or been asked or raised to ask, we wrestle with, all right, are they seven literal days? Why even use the word day? That's just confusing if it's not seven literal days. Get stuck in arguments about the days. And I think we're still asking the question around the days in ways that are probably not how ancient people would have thought about this at all. And sometimes we're still trying to think of sequence and origin. And hear me, last week, there's other texts that talk about how creation comes from nothing and all that kind of stuff. I don't think Genesis 1 is really concerned about a lot of that. Even this usage of days. That perhaps has less to do with God trying to describe any sort of literal timeline. And more about God essentially saying to these ancient people, hey, I know you know the stories. I know the little g gods have their little g temple, or not little g, little t temples. These little buildings that you can go and meet them at. And there were 7 days, 6 days where everybody brought the little things into the temple and set them up just right. And on the seventh day, they had the big party and God took up their spaces in these little temples scattered throughout the countryside. But me, Yahweh, this whole thing is my temple. The whole cosmos, even the dots that represent any other spiritual beings, I put those there. And that's a very different understanding of the world to any ancient person. But the use of the seven-week analogy, particularly in this setting and the resting on the seventh day, I would argue is very meant to convey that God is building a temple space and all the cosmos is where he dwells. I mean, imagine being told the God of the universe is not hiding behind a curtain in some temple, but he's here always, over all of it. And in case you think I'm a little bit crazy, these analogies like scatter throughout the rest of Scripture. So, tabernacle space, it's already sort of God's house in some ways, but what's inside the tabernacle in terms of another room? The Holy of Holies, right? What's on the curtain of the Holy of Holies? Anybody know? Cherubim. There's cherubim on the outside to guard the way into the Holy of Holies. All right. I'm going to give away a little bit of Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. We have the whole world, which is God's massive temple, but we also have a specific space where God uniquely dwells, right? He walks around in the cool of the day. We don't find that in the other spaces, but we do find it here. And as Adam and Eve get kicked out of the garden, what guards the way back in? Cherubim, right? So we have that analogy happening both in the tabernacle and, I would argue, in Genesis 1 through 3. We get these beautiful sort of pictures. Even in the making of the tabernacle, there's 7 let there be statements, and the last one is about Sabbathing. It's about resting. The Psalms talk about this all the time. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven, the sort of overseeing sort of role. Heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool, Isaiah 66. We get these sort of verses that are meant to convey that very idea that the cosmos itself is God's temple. He's not distant. The whole world is charged with his presence. And to keep going sort of how the analogy plays out, Noah preached on Revelation 21. If you keep reading in Revelation 21, eventually it describes the new temple, and the width of it, or the measurements of it, is essentially the Roman Empire at John's time. It's like the width of everything that they know and conquer and have any understanding of. And so the temple fills up all known space to John. And it's square, which is actually the measurements of the Holy of Holies. And if you keep reading, it'll eventually say, but there was no building there because God was the temple. And so the finale of the storyline is that the Holy of Holies ends up being the whole planet and that God will dwell with his people again. So these pictures, these words, these images get picked up and carried forth throughout Scripture. This is why the preface matters, because we will see this in story after story after story. Anyways, that's my diatribe on the temple. There's like 10 more sermons that can go with it. All right, and creation is marked also by goodness, right? This is sort of the who is Yahweh. Is Yahweh actually good? Does God care about goodness? And he sees things, and as he creates them, he's like, that's good. And the word tov, the word good there, I want to make sure we don't have the word perfect in our mind. Perfect is a very Greek thought more than a Hebrew thought. They don't talk about perfection very often. But it is good. It is fitting to its purpose. It's life-giving. It's harmonious. It's much more the image and language used of good. And part of the goodness is actually separating out things. It's hey, I need to move this over here so I can actually bring life over here. I need to limit the sea, or I need to limit darkness, or I need to limit chaos, not to oppress, but to actually create life. And there's rhythms, and there's times of rest and times of awake. There's evening and morning. There's these things built into creation. There's naming of the things. There's giving purpose and meaning. It converts identity, role. Like light has a purpose in the day and the night. The sky holds back the waters. The land is meant to yield the plants. And so there's separation, there's naming, there's boundaries, there's rhythms that all exist in this world. And there's goodness. And the baseline is goodness. I think our culture defaults to cynicism. It's actually sort of the Reformed tradition I tend to run in. It tends to default to, I think, Genesis 3 and 4 more than Genesis 1. That the world's actually starting point is goodness. The world is fundamentally a gift, not a curse. Even post-fall, God's goodness still has some undergirding in creation itself. And we'll hear Paul talk about how creation, between the fall and where we're headed, is groaning. It's longing for a return to the good. And so God created this world as a gift. And if we struggle to actually see the good, I think we'll never really join God in making more of the goodness with him. It's what Paul or Jesus will talk about in the Sermon on the Mount when he talks about the good eye, bad eye. It's like, do we actually see the goodness in this world that God may be doing? Or do we have a scarcity mindset? We're always worried. We're always anxious. But we also have to remember Genesis 1 wasn't written to us, but it was written for us. But we are a different time. The Israelites are asking questions. What kind of place is this? Where is God? Is this place actually good? And God's answering them. It's ordered. It's filled with my presence. It's blessed with my goodness. But we are on the other side of the fall. We know order was vandalized. The presence was resisted or broken. Goodness was doubted. The fall twist, that's where the good news of Jesus is called good. Chaos creeps back in. And that's where the good news of Jesus, that what was lost is actually being restored. He came to bring order where sin had brought disorder. He came to dwell with us where separation had actually grown and to show us the goodness of God that no one could miss. And in his death, the curse is broken. And in his resurrection, the creation, new creation has actually begun, as Noah talked about last week. The same God who spoke, or not last week, 2 weeks ago, the same God who spoke light into the darkness is now speaking life into the darkness of dead places. And if you belong to Christ, the truths of Genesis 1 are not just ancient history. They continue. They are present reality. And his order starts becoming your peace. His presence becomes your confidence. His goodness becomes your hope. Genesis 1 shows us how the world was meant to be, and the cross and the resurrection show us how God is going to bring it back. It's the dawn of a new creation. That's what the cross and resurrection show us. God's order, God's presence, goodness breaking back into the world. And the one who spoke life to darkness now speaks life into the grave. But here's why it matters. So if you're like, what does this have to do with life? All right, let's talk about that. I think God's order helps to actually bring peace to our own chaos. As we said, the beginning was tohu vavohu, formless and empty, chaotic, uninhabitable. But God didn't leave that there. He formed places. He filled them with life. He brought separation where there was confusion, beauty where there's disorder. God's not only creator, God is organizer. And his ordering is not sterile or mechanical. He's not the God of confusion. He's the God of peace, and that includes bringing things into order. And in him, all things hold together, speaking of Jesus. So not only is he the organizer in Genesis 1, he's the sustainer of that creation. The one who made the world also sustains it. And when we trust his ordering of the world, when we trust that it is good, we can rest instead of striving. We can follow his design. We experience peace instead of chaos. So what does God's order do for us? I think it guides us when we feel life feels disoriented, when it feels like, what should I do? Where should I go? How should I actually live? Well, his word's the lamp unto our feet. It provides instruction in some ways. It protects us from self-destruction. Deuteronomy 10 talks about commands that bring life and commands that bring death. And his commands are guardrails, but they're for our good. They're for flourishing. And it frees us from the tyranny of self-definition. As we said, God names things. He gives it purpose. We don't have to invent our own meaning, because that's a fragile state of mind to live in. But it's given by our Maker. So this week, I'll give one practical that kind of goes with each of these. Maybe identify one place in your life that feels just disordered. Just one, because you could spend hours identifying all of them. But your schedule, or your finances, or a relationship that you have. And what would it look like for God to bring order there? And to pray, God, help bring order here, and maybe take steps of what that looks like for God's design in those places. Next is, God's presence should bring confidence, particularly in our fears. If the cosmos is God's temple, then there's no such thing as God-forsaken ground. Like, we're never outside his domain. And if Genesis 1, that the temple's not a building in one city, it's the whole creation, and that means every street, every kitchen table, every hospital room, every university hallway is sacred space where God can reign. So when you feel unseen, when you feel abandoned, when you feel unempowered, whatever it is, Genesis 1 says God's there in that world, in that moment, in some ways. Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. So if God is ever-present, therefore, we will not fear. Presence makes courage possible to know that he's there. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. Because I am with you, because I am your God, fear not. And in Jesus, it's become so personal. In his birth, he's declared Emmanuel, God with us. And as he commissions his disciples in Matthew 28, he says, I am with you always to the end of the age. And then he puts his spirit in us, and then his spirit is part of not only us as our body, a temple, which is a whole other thing to think about, but even the community. So he's present. So what should this do for us? I think it anchors us when life feels unstable. Right? Psalm 23. Even when life is the valley of shadow of death, I'm not going to fear because your rod, your staff, your presence is there with me. It empowers us to live on mission, like in Acts 1. Essentially, Jesus is like, I'm going to send my spirit, and you're going to be my witnesses into the world. And his presence with them is what empowers and emboldens them to go proclaim the good news and then to comfort us in our pain. 2 Corinthians 1, God's present as a comforter. And it sanctifies all the ordinary places and the ordinary parts of our faith. Your home, your workplace, your commute become spaces where heaven can meet earth. So begin, maybe this week, begin your day, maybe tomorrow morning, picturing just one place you'll be. An office, a classroom, a coffee shop, wherever it is. And consciously sort of invite God into that, or preemptively invite God into that. Lord, I know I'm going to be going there. It's your space. Let me carry your presence here. And then lastly, God's goodness leads to hope in our discouragement. From the first page of Scripture, God looks at his creation as tov, as good. Not perfect, but good. And he gives us days marked by boundaries and rhythms and blessing. God separates light, darkness, sea, land, not to limit life, but to make